proceed, please. Case number one.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jay Tharp. I'm representing appellant Ernst & Young, and for the purposes of the argument this morning, also appellant Charles Roach. Your Honors, we're here today because the lower courts refused to enforce written arbitration agreements between Ernst & Young and the debtors, in this case, Baker O'Neill Holdings and American Public Automotive Group. The Federal Arbitration Act requires federal courts, including bankruptcy courts, to enforce written arbitration agreements. But the lower courts in this case did not do so. And in failing to do so, they ignored more than 50 years of case law that were standing in their way. Your Honors, the lower courts concluded that it would be inconsistent to enforce the arbitration agreements in this case, and that the confirmed plan of confirmation in the bankruptcy case trumped the arbitration agreements between Ernst & Young and the debtors in this case, because the confirmed plan included a provision by which the bankruptcy court retained jurisdiction to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. That proposition, that the confirmed plan trumped the arbitration agreements, is wrong for at least five reasons, Your Honors. For starters, the idea that there is anything inconsistent with the exercise of a court's jurisdiction and the enforcement of an arbitration agreement went down the tubes a long time ago. That's the words of this court in the Northwestern National Insurance case. And in fact, Your Honors, that notion went down the tubes more than 50 years ago when the Supreme Court decided the Anaconda case and explicitly held that enforcement of an arbitration agreement pursuant to the Federal Arbitration Act does not oust a court of its jurisdiction.
In these particular circumstances, isn't the real issue whether the word adjudicate alters things so that ordinary trial litigation replaces arbitration?
Well, that's certainly an issue that's been raised, Your Honor. Our initial point...
Well, isn't that the issue? Does it do that?
What the bankruptcy confirmed plan does, Your Honor, is states that the bankruptcy court will retain its jurisdiction to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. And there's a couple of concepts that relate to that phrase that are particularly germane, as Your Honor points out. What the confirmed plan did was ensure that the bankruptcy court retained its jurisdiction to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. No one disputes, not even the debtors dispute, that before confirmation of the plan, the bankruptcy court had jurisdiction to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. And that jurisdiction to adjudicate included the authority and indeed the obligation to enforce a written arbitration agreement. The debtors conceded as much in their initial response to the arbitration motion when they conceded that some of their claims were in fact arbitrable. Your Honor, the phrase to adjudicate that retention of jurisdiction to adjudicate was a necessary component of the bankruptcy confirmation plan.
Because, why wouldn't it have been just enough to say shall retain its jurisdiction of the adversary proceeding?
Because, Your Honor, the Supreme Court in the Moses Cohn case expressly held that the Federal Arbitration Act does not confer an independent basis of jurisdiction on a federal court to entertain an arbitration motion. To entertain a motion under the Federal Arbitration Act, the court must have an independent basis of jurisdiction. It must have jurisdiction to adjudicate the underlying controversy between the parties. Without that jurisdiction to adjudicate the underlying controversy, a court cannot even entertain a motion under the Federal Arbitration Act. So it was imperative that the bankruptcy court have jurisdiction to adjudicate the underlying controversy between the parties to enable it to hear the arbitration motion.
But in construing these terms, why is the word adjudicate necessary? All it had, the bankruptcy court was going to retain its jurisdiction, same jurisdiction it had before, over an adversary proceeding and other things.
I think the reason for that, Your Honor, is the bankruptcy court didn't necessarily retain the full measure of its jurisdiction post-confirmation. The point of the confirmation plan was to specify those particular aspects of its pre-confirmation jurisdiction that it retained post-confirmation. And one of those specific aspects was its authority to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. The other aspect that goes to Your Honor's question here is that adjudication includes the obligation to consider the claims and defenses advanced by all the parties to the litigation, including the defendant. The resolution of an arbitration motion under the Federal Arbitration Act is adjudication, as many courts have used that specific term, and those cases are cited in our brief.
Did Ernst and Young insist on arbitration prior to it, for the confirmation of the plan?
I'm sorry, did they, Your Honor?
Right.
Your Honor, Ernst & Young raised it, or filed this arbitration motion.
Just answer, did they request it?
Ernst & Young did not request arbitration in the confirmation proceeding, Your Honor. That was a proceeding in the bankruptcy
court. That's not what I asked you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did Ernst & Young insist on arbitration prior to the confirmation of the plan in bankruptcy court?
No, Your Honor. Ernst & Young had not filed anything requesting arbitration at that point in time. Ernst & Young filed its arbitration motion at the point that its responsive pleading was due in the adversary proceeding, which is the proceeding in which the arbitration would take place. And, Your Honor, I'd ask
Wouldn't
the court...
Wouldn't that have protected them from this problem if they had?
It certainly would have raised the issue at an earlier point in time, Your Honor.
And protected them, in all probability.
I guess that depends on the resolution of the case, Your
That's
Honor.
Right,
but,
right.
I think an important point here, Your Honor, is the district court kind of went down that same path, suggesting that Ernst & Young should have filed this earlier as a means of alerting the court and saving judicial resources and that sort of thing. Let me address that for a moment, Your Honor. Had Ernst & Young taken that path today, more than 2 years after the original proposed reorganization plan was filed, the plan would still not be confirmed, because here we are today, 2 years later, still litigating an arbitration motion. What will imposing a rule that you have to seek to arbitrate during a confirmation proceeding is going to engender a mass of protective filings by any creditor who's got an arbitration agreement with the debtors, whether or not an adversary proceeding has been filed or is likely to be filed. And all that's going to accomplish is to delay, by a significant period of time, the confirmation proceedings, as this case is perhaps the absolute best evidence of that fact. All that would have accomplished in this case is to delay the confirmation of the confirmed plan, in this case, by 2 years. The debtors and creditors would still be waiting for confirmation of their plan 2 years after the proposed plan was submitted. Your Honor, that phrase, the retention of jurisdiction, was a prerequisite to the bankruptcy court's ability to hear the arbitration motion in the first place. There was nothing inconsistent in the plan with Ernst & Young's intention to arbitrate, and there was nothing in the plan that impinged Ernst & Young's ability to arbitrate. That provision was a necessary predicate to allow Ernst & Young to bring the arbitration motion.
Are you going to address the argument that this phrase, retain jurisdiction to adjudicate, with the adjudicate part of it introduced some ambiguity, which gave you the burden that you must object to the plan to clear that up.
I would like to address that, Your Honor, and I think the first response to that is it doesn't introduce any ambiguity, Your Honor. That was a necessary predicate to allow Ernst & Young to bring its arbitration motion. That was a provision of the plan that Ernst & Young wouldn't object to. That was a provision of the plan that Ernst & Young would have insisted on. Second, Your Honor, the idea that this introduced some ambiguity, perhaps the best evidence that is a fallacious argument, Your Honor, is the fact that this argument that the plan was somehow inconsistent with the arbitration rights didn't surface for 3.5 months after Ernst & Young had filed its arbitration motion. As I mentioned earlier, in their original response to the arbitration motion, the debtors didn't identify any inconsistency between the confirmed plan and the arbitration motion. Instead, the debtors conceded that, in fact, some of their claims were subject to arbitration. The debtors filed a surreply in the briefing on the arbitration motion in which they again conceded that some of their claims were, in fact, arbitrable and did not identify any inconsistency between the confirmed plan and any right of arbitration. It was only 3.5 months later when counsel for the creditors came in on the morning of the hearing on the motion and first presented the idea that there was any inconsistency. And in doing so, counsel for the creditors committee candidly acknowledged that this was an argument that had been worked up the night before. Your Honors, that is the best evidence that there is, in fact, no inconsistency here at all. At least, there's no inconsistency on the part of Ernst & Young. And that's the best evidence that there is, in fact, no real ambiguity here. It was not an ambiguity that occurred to the bankruptcy court. It was not an ambiguity that occurred to the debtors, and it was certainly not an ambiguity that occurred to Ernst & Young. It was a provision of the plan that was, from Ernst & Young's perspective, a required provision of the plan to enable Ernst & Young to bring that arbitration motion. I'm entering my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so unless there's questions right now, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Fine. All right, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Andy Hull with the law firm Hoover, Hull, Baker, and Heath in Indianapolis, Indiana. With me today are my colleagues, Alice Morkel and Sean White. We are counsel to two debtors in a confirmed bankruptcy plan, Baker O'Neill Holdings and American Public Automotive Group. In this adversary proceeding, both the bankruptcy court and the district court found that Ernst & Young had lost its pre-confirmation contractual right to arbitration. Both lower courts held that the confirmed plan superseded the earlier contractual right to arbitration. This conclusion is soundly based upon contract principles, upon authorities recognizing the effect of a confirmed bankruptcy plan of reorganization, and the plain language of the plan itself. Both lower courts also held that Ernst & Young waived its contractual right to arbitration. This ruling is based upon the plan confirmation, upon Ernst & Young's representations and omissions at the plan confirmation stage, and Ernst & Young's delay in filing the arbitration motion until after the plan confirmation had occurred.
Unless the phrase adjudication somehow trumps arbitration, there was no occasion for them to object, was there?
Your Honor, I believe that the phrase that the plan uses, in fact, does squarely trump the earlier contractual right. And I might add, but before addressing that particular point, that the cases that we have cited to the court make clear that in the bankruptcy context, rights are preserved, or rights are lost when not expressly preserved. For example, the In Re Penrod case, a case in which a creditor loses its lien right on a plan that is silent. There is no language at all. In this case, there is language, and it is specific language.
Well, here you're dealing with procedure, not substantive rights.
I take issue with Ernst & Young's characterization that they somehow welcomed this phrase in the plan, that it was an intentional action on their part, because the motion that they filed, the arbitration motion, is a motion to dismiss the adversary proceeding. That's the relief that they sought. The relief that they sought was directly counter to the concept that the court would retain jurisdiction to adjudicate the adversary proceeding. In addition, we have cited the court...
Dismissal is an exercise of jurisdiction.
It is an exercise of jurisdiction, but under the Leatherby case, it is not an adjudication. It is not a decision that is binding on the merits. And therein lies the distinction, Your Honor. We have cited to the court authorities that construe or consider the word adjudicate. And in connection with Black's Law Dictionary, a definition that the bankruptcy court relied upon, there was the definition to settle in the exercise of judicial authority to determine finally. We also directed the court to Justice Ginsburg's opening remarks for a unanimous Supreme Court in the Marathon Oil case, in which the court was recognizing that an adjudication was a binding resolution of a controversy on the merits. I think, Your Honor, that there's no question that an adjudication is a binding determination on the merits. The Prima Paint case, a case that Ernst & Young relies upon...
Well, the real question is whether adjudication means procedure by litigation in the ordinary course before the court rather than arbitration.
Well, I think that...
In order to trump arbitration, adjudication has to mean that somehow this plan said we're going to hear this in the normal judicial process.
I think the only fair reading of that language is that the bankruptcy court will adjudicate the adversary proceeding, the plain words of the plan itself.
Right, you keep saying that, of course, it literally says adjudication, but the question is, what does that mean?
Well, in the case of Prima Paint, for example, Your Honor, the court considered whether under Sections 3 and 4 of the Arbitration Act, what circumstances would cause a court to adjudicate the issue of fraud in the inducement. For example, the making or performance of a contract that is subject to the Arbitration Act. And the court is very clear in that case that the statute requires a court to adjudicate that issue, the making and performance of a contract that is subject to the Arbitration Act. The question that you have to ask yourself, I think the meaning of the word adjudicate is clear. It's a trial on the merits that is binding on the parties. The real question is, adjudicate what? And Prima Paint makes clear that Section 3 and 4 erode the power or the authority of an arbitration provision and say that a court will adjudicate fraud in the inducement. This plan is very clear as to what will be adjudicated. The adversary proceeding, not a Section 3 or Section 4 motion under the Arbitration Act. If Ernst & Young was seeking to preserve that right, that is what they should have walked into court and done. They should have made two objections to the plan, not just an objection to the Baker release. They should have made an objection to the language that the court was retaining jurisdiction to adjudicate. If they were truly concerned about the court retaining jurisdiction in order to hear a Section 3 or Section 4 motion under the Arbitration Act, then say so. But that is not what they did.
After the plan, confirmed plan, did this issue concerning the arbitration included, or that the adjudication included arbitration?
The plan was confirmed in February of 2000. In March of 2000, Ernst & Young first filed its arbitration motion in the adversary proceeding. There was briefing up to September of 2000 when the bankruptcy court ruled. It is true that the debtors did not initially raise the issue of the preclusive effect of the plan on the parties' relationships. It is also true that when creditor or committee counsel raised the argument, debtors joined in the argument, the hearing was continued, all parties had an opportunity to brief that issue, there was absolutely no prejudice or harm occasioned on Ernst & Young, and a subsequent hearing with oral argument was had on the issue of the preclusive effect of the plan on extinguishing the right to arbitration.
Doesn't that show that really up to that point nobody really thought about that, including arbitration?
I think it's fair to say that that I had not thought about it. I was not personally involved in the negotiation of the plan terms, but that is not the relevant inquiry for a number of reasons. In Ray Penrod would say, if you don't preserve your pre-confirmation right, you lose it. And the right we're talking about here is no more important than a lien right. In fact, arguably, it's far less important than a lien right. There are any number of cases, for example, cabinetry from this jurisdiction, that make very clear that the federal policy behind the Arbitration Act is simply a policy to enforce contracts. That's all it is. There is no preference of arbitration over litigation. So in this case, all that the lower courts have done is to, in fact, follow that federal policy. They are upholding the contract, the new contract, the confirmed plan. It's also important to recognize that In re Harvey establishes that if there was any question, any ambiguity, any vagueness, any objection to the terms of a plan, the creditor or the participant must make that objection prior to plan confirmation, or the opportunity to object is waived. We made the argument at the district court below that this appeal is moot, and I believe that to be the case. This appeal is moot. The issue had to be raised at plan confirmation and had to be appealed if, in fact, Ernst & Young was unable to get the relief, the enforcement of the arbitration provision that they sought. And the final point to address this idea of intent is that that is not the relevant inquiry. And once again, In re Harvey, I think, looks at that issue. The question is not whether there was a meeting of the minds in terms of the plan language. That is not the appropriate inquiry. The language here is clear, and it is unambiguous, and the court is enforcing its own language. It's in the nature of a consent decree, as is discussed in the Harvey case. Ernst & Young really doesn't have the opportunity, and it's not a relevant inquiry, to come in and say, in the adversary, well, that's not what I was intending by that plan language.
Excuse me, is it your position that the judge then was interpreting, in effect, his own order?
I think that is one way to look at what this judge did. I don't think it is the only way to look at what this judge did. I think this court, sua sponte, had the issue not been raised by the plan committee or the debtors, this court, sua sponte, could have enforced its plan and required that this case be adjudicated before the bankruptcy court. I don't think there's any question about it. One of the cases relied upon by Ernst & Young is the In re GWI case. And they cite this for the proposition that a case should be arbitrated if there's an arbitration provision somewhere in the plan. Well, it's actually a fascinating case. The court had a retention of jurisdiction to adjudicate provision in the plan. But the plan also had a specific provision that incorporated a stock purchase and escrow agreement. And that document had an arbitration provision. What the court recognized was that was a more specific direction as to whether that particular dispute over the purchase and escrow agreement should be arbitrated or should be litigated. And because the document that incorporated the right to arbitration was itself incorporated into the plan, the court was enforcing its plan. And I think that's yet another example of a court enforcing its own plan to achieve the result that was dictated by the plan. In our brief, we have cited cases at pages 18 to 23, literally dozens of cases that recognize that a plan extinguishes the prior relationship between creditor and debtor and creates the new rights and obligations. There is nothing novel about extending that principle to the right of arbitration, just as there was nothing novel about extending that principle to the issue of lien rights in the case of In Re Penrod. There has to be a first case. In Re Penrod was the first case in the Seventh Circuit recognizing that lien rights, which were thought to simply pass through bankruptcies untouched, were in fact lost, if not expressly preserved, in the bankruptcy plan. In this case, it's not a question of omission. It's a case of language that expressly provided that the bankruptcy court would adjudicate the adversary proceeding. There is no ability of Ernst & Young at this point in time to come in and argue about ambiguities, argue about defects, argue about objections. They have waived that right under the analysis in Harvey. Now, that both the district court and the bankruptcy court also found that there was an implied waiver of the right to arbitration. And we believe the courts were correct in that respect. Implied waiver arises from the totality of the circumstances. It does not require the intentional relinquishment of a known right, as is cited by Ernst & Young. It does not require a showing of prejudice. It simply requires actions that are inconsistent with the right to arbitrate. There is no question that when Ernst & Young came before the bankruptcy court leveraging an argument to make its objection to the Baker release and identifying rights and interests and claims that they were seeking to preserve in that context, they acted inconsistently. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Your Honors, Mr. Hull conceded that there is no case, not a single case among the myriad cases that are cited in the debtor's brief, that hold that a confirmed plan of reorganization in bankruptcy discharges arbitration rights. Every case cited by the debtors is a case that involves the discharge of claims and interest in the debtor's property, including cases that address lien rights. A lien is a claim on property. That is the proper and expected province of a discharge in bankruptcy. But there is no authority anywhere that permits a confirmed plan to trump or discharge arbitration rights. There is no provision in law that permits the bankruptcy court to trump those arbitration rights. And the debtors have not identified a single case. We have identified cases, post-confirmation cases, enforcing arbitration rights, but you don't have to look very far to realize the ludicrousness of that proposition. Because if the bankruptcy confirmed plan discharged the contract rights in this case, the debtors couldn't be suing on that very same contract. This is a contract claim, an arbitration motion based on the very same contract that the debtors have sued Ernst & Young on. If that contract is discharged, there could be no suit on that contract.
That BWI, which you cited, didn't the courts explicitly retain arbitration? You know, with a provision in there that notwithstanding anything else, they'll still continue arbitration?
No, Your Honor. There was a provision that referenced the contract that contained the arbitration provision, and there was also a retention of jurisdiction provision. There was no provision in the plan that said the bankruptcy court will retain jurisdiction to refer this case to arbitration. It was just a provision that referenced the contract that was issued with between the parties, in the same way that the bankruptcy court here referenced the adversary proceeding that includes the contract claims on the very same contract that pertains to the arbitration provision here.
All right, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will proceed to case number